Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Smashy Business Show. Today is September 27th, 2024. It is Friday. The weekend is here. My name is Hind Al-Dah, and I'm here with my co-host, Abdul Majid Awan. Abdul Majid, any interesting news today?
No, I just read a few good things today. Mm-hmm. It's not businessy, but I told you about it. We were discussing it that UAE has a very good initiative for the Gazan people. The Emirates Humanitarian City is basically housing nearly 2,000 patients from Gaza now, and they're being housed at EHC as part of UAE's continuing humanitarian operations in solidarity with the Palestinians. And about 150 medical appointments are carried out each day. Apart from that, a separate building for EHC includes a pharmacy clinic and a ward with hospital best staffed by doctors, pediatricians, and internal medicine specialists, psychiatrists, dentists, and rehabilitation specialists. So it's a whole big line of different kinds of doctors, and especially the pediatricians for kids. So EHC has a team of more than 50 people serving kids, and there's a school there as well, which is catering to 400 children. So
let's
a great move to start
with.
Yeah,
I mean, let's hope more people are able to get the proper medical treatment.
And apart from that, it's also psychological treatment and psychological counseling that they're receiving there. It's a very good move.
Yeah.
Thank you, UAE.
Other than that, this morning we'll have a special guest, the former Vice President and Tourism Minister, Ahmed Adib, of the Maldives. And this is in honor of World Tourism Day, which is today. So make sure you're tuned in at the end of the show where we'll talk to him about the Maldives. I mean, I'm very excited to find out how the Maldives is, how it is today because of the tourism and all the work that the tourism minister has put in. Let's get into the main news of this morning. UAE and New Zealand seal trade deal. Middle Eastern investors pump $9 billion into China. And Meta unveils Orion AR glasses. First of all, the UAE is just pumping out SEPA agreements left and right.
Yeah.
I mean, we just talked about the finalization of the SEPA agreement with Australia, and now New Zealand comes into the picture. And Majid was just telling me earlier that this is going to help New Zealand a lot,
yeah.
Because let's just get into the main crux of the story. Yeah.
So SEPAs are, everyone knows, Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreements. UAE has a target to sign 26 to 28 SEPAs by the end of this decade, by 2030. And they're very well on the target. They've done nearly 13 to 14 SEPAs now.
Yeah.
Some of them are already in motion. The one with India, which was the first SEPA that UAE signed with anyone, that is in motion already. It's been nearly 2 years now, and we've seen a lot of trade increase because of that SEPA agreement with India.
We've seen both countries reap the benefits of this agreement.
And it's very basic maths. You send your stuff to their country, and you pay less taxes for doing trade in their country. They send their stuff. So it's a very good bilateral agreement that UAE started with India, and now they've moved on to so many countries, and New Zealand is the latest addition. The fact that we are talking about is that New Zealand statistically has a very big dairy and poultry industry. Mm-hmm. So that industry will be very good. The products, wool, meat,
everything. Have a lot of sheep.
Yeah, they have a lot of sheep.
More than people.
Yeah,
more than people.
And all the byproducts of sheep, the wool, the clothing materials, the meat, everything, it can now easily enter in the UAE, and the tariff will be reduced by 98.5%.
Wow.
So that's a big number. And over the period of 3 years, they finalized that it will move to 99%. So 0.5% increase. So this is a move that UAE is making, but not only New Zealand. They earlier did it with Australia.
Yeah.
And Australia, for the very first time in their history, signed a bilateral trade agreement with a Middle Eastern country. And it was UAE.
Mm-hmm.
So they chose UAE. So.
Yeah. So this agreement with New Zealand only took about 4 months of, reached after 4 months of negotiations, which is quite a short time. And this deal aims to increase even more bilateral trade between the two countries and boost ties with the Asia Pacific region. So UAE's non-oil trade with New Zealand in 2023 was valued at $460.3 million, which was up 11.5%. And New Zealand is the UAE's largest trading partner in the Middle East. and accounts for 50% of its trade with the MENA region. I feel like the UAE is kind of the number one spot trader in the Middle East region with other countries. So, and the New Zealand agriculture and manufacturing sectors offer a significant potential for the UAE, and it will of course boost investments between the two countries.
And we talked about New Zealand exports dairy, meat, and industrial products. So dairy and meat are like their biggest products coming out of New Zealand. Even if you're a student or you're just listening to our show as a person who is doing his bachelor's or master's, if you want New Zealand nationality or Australian nationality, you can always do a bachelor's or master's in those fields in that country, and you can always move there.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, because whenever you apply for New Zealand, the best idea is to go into these industries. Uh-huh. So. Poultry, farming, all these industries, they love to take these people.
They're the most profitable.
Yeah, because these are the biggest industries and they need experts from these kind of industries to come into their country. Mm. So yeah, nationality-wise, passport-wise, New Zealand is also great. It has one of the best passports in the world. So this is one of the industries. UAE is also signing multiple CEPA agreements. We talked about it. Similar agreements are in place with India and Australia. And also CEPA includes sections on sustainable development, labor, and climate. So it's not just that they will do trade. One of the part of the agreement says that we will increase our sustainable development and you will also increase it.
I think that's the case with most things that the UAE does. It's very much focused on sustainability and they're trying to progress in that aspect. So it's good that most of what their agreements and most of their initiatives always has this this section on sustainability and climate change and whatnot. So it's very good. I'm happy with that.
Yeah, as a Marathi, as the national of this country, it is a moment of pride. And as a resident also, it's a moment of pride that this country focuses so much on sustainability because the future generations need this planet also. Mm-hmm. And the last number that we should talk about in this story is that UAE aims for 4 trillion dirhams in foreign trade by 2031. So this is like their target, and this CEPA agreements are the tool that they're using to reach this target.
Yes. Let's move on to our second story of the day. Middle Eastern investors pump $9 billion into China while others retreat.
Yeah.
So Middle Eastern investors led by the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority and the PIF, the Saudi Public Investment Fund. Oh, sorry. It's led by IADIA and Mubadala.
And it's all of them. All the big wealth funds, they're contributing a lot of money to China.
Yeah, so they're investing record capital into China. Yeah. And the notable deals include ADIA stake in Media Group, which is a like appliance company. They invested $4 billion and they're involved with an $8.3 billion deal with Dalian Wanda Group. And Saudi Arabia's PIF bought $2 billion worth of bonds from Lenovo as part of a strategic partnership. Another number, $9 billion in deals have been made this year, which is a record for Middle Eastern firms in mainland China.
And still we have like 2 or 3 months left in the year, so this number is surely going to go up.
Yeah.
And Middle East investors find these Chinese assets undervalued because a lot of Western countries are moving away from China. It's the basically geopolitical issue that US and China are rivals on the political and the economic landscape. US wants to become the biggest economy. China wants to become the biggest economy. Both have their agendas as per their economic policies. So Middle East sees that when there's no one investing in China, this is the best time.
It's a big win for the Middle Eastern countries.
And it's a big win for China as well. It's always the best part about Middle East countries, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Egypt, any country you talk about, when they do deals with other countries, it's always a win-win for both countries.
Yeah.
They always find opportunities where either someone is leaving or they see benefit in the future, far future, near future, that depends. But they always do deals which benefit the other party as well. It's not just their benefit.
Yeah.
So they're undervalued right now because other people are leaving. So they've invested in it. And competition is less. We've seen that Chinese companies are also setting up in the UAE a lot. I recently read a report and we talked about it on the show as well that the Expo City, which hosted the Expo 2020, now has more Chinese companies than any other country.
Oh, wow.
So China is coming to the UAE, setting up business here. Again, ease of doing business and then open arms, a very good environment for all expats, all countries, all nationalities. So that is why China is moving here and we're moving there with our money.
Exactly.
Yeah, and they are key players globally, obviously backing deals worth $55 billion in 2024, the Middle Eastern countries.
Mm-hmm.
And China's geopolitical tensions and slower economy have stopped a lot of people. But Middle East is not stopping. They're going there. And the collaboration is happening in healthcare sector, in manufacturing, technology, energy. They're offering growth opportunities to Chinese with their money.
Mm-hmm. So Saudi's Aramco plans further investment in chemical plants and is exploring deals with Hengli Petrochemical as well as other firms. And Middle Eastern funds continue to diversify into tech, clean energy, and industrial sectors. The focus is expanding beyond China, with ADIA and Mubadala also investing in Southeast Asia, India, and Japan. So investors are exploring chip making, AI, and electric vehicle batteries with long-term ambitions to reshape their economies.
So yeah, it's part of the move from moving away from oil. So when you move away from oil, you move out of your country, you obviously go to every region.
Yes.
And in European markets, even Saudi and UAE-based funds, they have trillions of dollars invested. We did a story.
In so many different sectors, right?
Yeah,
like sports.
We also did a story yesterday about ADIA and Mubadala. Actually, it was 1 second. I'll give you the exact thing so I don't. Masdar. So that is like the sustainable arm of the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund. They have expanded their European renewable energy portfolio and have invested $1.4 billion to acquire Saita, which is a Spanish company. So in renewable energy, they're also investing. They're investing everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason, they want to move away from oil and still keep their money intact.
Yeah, so of course, that's a smart move to do, is to look at other sectors and invest in those. I think as well, it's that they plan to have their youth be primed to fill those spots in all these different sectors. So I'm sure they're also focusing on research and university and development and stuff like that. So pretty good. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Let's move on to our final story of the day.
It's not related to Middle East, but it's a very big tech development.
Yeah, it's a big thing. Another new technology is being unveiled. So Meta unveils Orion AR glasses as the future of augmented reality. Now we've all are aware with augmented reality or VR or however you want to call it.
Yeah.
But Meta introduced these Orion AR glasses, as they are called, at its Meta Connect event, which is described by Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO, as the most advanced glasses the world has ever seen. I think most people like to call their own. CEOs like to say whatever they make is the best or whatever, but. Compared to the previous glasses, they seem to be more efficient at what they do. So the glasses will feature tiny projectors that create a heads-up display for true augmented reality, and will position the glasses as an eventual smartphone alternative. What do you think about that? An alternative to your smartphone?
When I saw the video of him presenting the product itself looks great, obviously, because it's still in prototype. It's not available for everyone. The problem that I saw and the good things that I saw, I'll talk about the good things first. It has a very wide vision, focus vision, basically the word, I can't remember the exact word, but it has a wide field. So the good thing about it
is peripheral vision.
Yeah. So when you're looking at the world, for example, if I'm looking right now at the camera or anything, I will see all of this. But I'll have hologram displays of different tabs, or maybe I'll have WhatsApp open here and some other app open here. So you have multiple windows open. So it's good for multitasking. That's what I saw in it. Because when he was presenting it, he was like, you can play games with your friends. So you don't need a table now. You don't need a ball or a racket to play ping pong with your friends.
You don't need to move, basically. Just wear your glasses.
No, you can move your hand. That's it. Because it comes with a wristband also.
Yeah.
And you can see it. You can play pong with your friends. You don't need a table, you know. So you can do that. Another feature that I saw, it was the video didn't show much of it. But for example, if I am here and Hind is in US, America, wherever she is, if we both are wearing the glasses, I can see a hologramic view of her in front of me. So it's like teleporting, but in the form of a hologram. So whenever this comes out, to be honest, I will try it, because I'm not a fan of glasses because I already wear glasses. Mm-hmm. So using them above these glasses is very difficult. The VR headsets, I've tried VR gaming as well. It's a lot of problem with for people with glasses.
Mm-hmm.
But in the video, demo video, he showed one person who took off the glasses and wore these glasses. So
will they be catered to whatever?
Yeah, that person said that everything looks clear. Huh. So again,
see, one thing I was worried about is you know, when you spend too much time on staring at a screen,
yeah.
you get headaches and migraines. Yeah. So I'm a bit worried, like if you wear these glasses for a long period of time, and since what you're seeing is through a screen.
Yeah.
Will that be an issue? I mean,
the point of him saying that you can see the real world and then some holographic displays, it's not a screen as per se the local products have.
Mm-hmm.
It's not glass. It's made of some fiber, some very expensive fiber. To tell you that $10,000 reportedly are used to make one glass.
Yeah, so if you have 10K lying around, maybe get these glasses and try them out.
Yeah, so if that's 10K for production, I don't know how much they're going to sell it for. The finer details they're figuring out, Mark Zuckerberg himself said that soon it will be available, but they're doing the finer details. Maybe it's that, because a lot of people have vision issues, a lot of people get headaches from these things. The VR sets that we've seen throughout, they have caused migraines and headaches for a lot of people. So the technology is gradually becoming better. But these glasses, to be honest, I've never seen anything like it. He told us about the prototype, the original product. When it comes out, then we'll see. But as per the video that he presented it, I don't think it's something that we've seen ever, to be honest. I agree with his statement.
I suppose it's good that he's advancing his brand of like the metaverse. So I suppose like if you put these glasses on, it will be kind of like the metaverse where like you see holograms and everything is it's in like augmented reality.
So basically what happened was 10 years ago, again, another report that 10 years ago, they started developing the metaverse, and it was a very big thing at that point. A lot of shops opened there. People were buying land in the metaverse. It was a very big thing, but it slowly died down. The fever died down as soon as people got fed up of it, maybe, or people found it like, it's not the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of investment went into it. Nearly $50 billion were invested in the metaverse project. And Orion is one part of that project. And apparently, half of the money, which was like earmarked for the metaverse, went into the development of this glass. So this glass comes to you after 10 years of R&D, right? Research and development. It's not like just one day ago he decided that we'll make sunglass. And it has a very sophisticated internal workings. If you see the video, you'll see that he has pointed out every small part of it, that how it works. So just to tell you technicalities, I hope you understand, Orion glasses feature tiny projectors, basically. So it's not that you're looking at a screen on your glass. You're looking at a projected image from the projectors. So they create a heads-up display for true augmented reality, positioning the glasses as eventual smartphone alternatives. Again, I told you, there's multiple windows that can open in front of you, so you won't need your phone. And one more thing that I saw was the neural interface I was telling you about.
Mm-hmm.
So you wear a wristband, and Zuckerberg himself imitated the whole action, that telling that, glasses, do this, Orion, do this. Sometimes people will think you're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And also, using hand movements, he's like, it's great, sometimes you need them. But doing
and
that in the...
it's normal to do this like out
but
in public.
Doing this in public or something feels weird. You're not Tony Stark. You're not Iron
not
Man.
Not very subtle.
Yeah, not very subtle. So he's like, they've created a band which goes with it. And your wrist movement. So it's like the first glasses which have a neural link as well. So they'll be connected to your neural network. And you can move your wrist to do a lot of actions. So you can just stand there and move your wrist and maybe read a message, accept a call or something. So no wires, no nothing. Great product. Again, when it comes to the market and people use it, we'll get the original ideas. But from the video, it looks very promising.
Yeah. So developers will have early access to Orion to start building apps. Of course, apps will be needed.
Hmm.
With Meta refining the glasses for a consumer release in the coming year. So, of course, they're just releasing prototypes and having tests, people testing them out for feedback and for, again, research and development before the actual launch. And the glasses will focus on creating a seamless blend of digital content and the physical environment, with future updates likely to introduce new use cases and like life-size holograms. Meta will continue its R&D efforts, including a smaller HUD version, and release new devices leading up to Orion's official launch, pushing AR into everyday wearables. So I guess Mark Zuckerberg wants us all to
wear
Orion glasses and be in an augmented reality.
Yeah, but the last thing that I can think of, the last time I saw something this big come was Google Glass. But it failed miserably because of the privacy issues, because you could wear it and record anything and take pictures anywhere. But it has a very bad voice feedback. So you're like, Google Glass, take a picture. You literally had to shout. Mm-hmm. So that was like the very first time someone introduced that, something of that sort, some kind of technology which was wearable. Now, this is the second time I've seen something so much promising. Mm-hmm. So I hope it doesn't fall like the Google Glass mammoth fell.
I mean, a lot of research is going into it. So hopefully it's like leading up to the official launch, it will be in prime conditions for like people to enjoy and
what I've seen is technology moves faster than light. That is what I believe. So in the next 10 years, maybe we'll all be wearing those glasses. You will be, I will be.
Yeah.
We won't need the teleprompters.
Exactly.
We won't need the cameras. Everything will be done with through our glasses.
Yeah.
So yeah, looking forward to the future.
Yeah.
So this is all that we talked about. UAE and New Zealand have signed a SEPA trade deal. UAE is on course to sign nearly 28 SEPAs by the end of this decade, 2030. They want to bring in 4 trillion dirhams through them. And this New Zealand finalization of the SEPA is just a step in that. Middle Eastern investors, the big wealth funds, have invested $9 billion into China. When everyone is moving away, they're buying the undervalued assets right now. And lastly, we talked about Meta's Orion glasses, that how they are shaping the future of wearable on face technology. And now we have a guest in a few minutes. Just stay with us.
We'll take a short break. Make sure you stay tuned in to hear more from Ahmed Adib, who is the former vice president and tourism minister of the Maldives.
And today is World Tourism Day. So we'll have a nice chat. See you then.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us again. Today on the show, we have the former vice president and tourism minister of the Maldives. Please welcome Ahmed Adib.
Thank you.
How are you feeling today?
I'm doing very well.
Yeah. Well, first off, let's just get right into it. We just want to know, we want to dive into your personal journey. So where did you grow up? What did you study? And also, what inspired you to delve into the world of politics?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Of course.
Yeah, I was born in Maldives. I grew up there. My background is I was a football player, professionally soccer.
Nice.
So I played for all the junior national teams.
Mm-hmm.
But I studied business administration. I did my degree in Staffordshire University in UK.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did my MBA in Australia, Edith Cowan University in Perth. And then I returned Maldives in 2009, where there was democratic elections and there was a lot of politics going on. So I came up through the media. So I was a business analyst and also a debater in economic policies.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, nice.
So through Chamber of Commerce, they elected me to their board. I was doing freelance consulting. So I came up through the media, I can say, and then dwell into politics.
Yeah.
And then there was very famous President Nasheed. He resigned, the vice president came in and formed a national government, where I was invited through one of the biggest political parties to be the Minister of Tourism.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like 28 years old at that time.
Wow, so.
Yeah, so we saw you were the youngest tourism minister.
I was the youngest tourism minister as well as youngest vice president of our country.
Wow, so from a professional footballer to a politician.
I mean,
that's an amazing transition.
Yeah.
I noticed you're wearing a pin. Can you tell us, what does that mean?
Yeah, this is our country's national emblem.
Oh, okay.
So we have a 1,000 years old of kingdom. So it was worn by our kings, later on by our presidents, vice presidents.
So let's talk about Maldives. Again, you've been the tourism minister. How did Maldives become what Maldives is today? Because I was reading about Maldives this year's performance. It's astronomical. The numbers are great. So Maldives tourism industry, they saw nearly 1.2 million tourists, and that reflects like a 10% increase in the number of tourists. So every year it's increasing. How did it happen? Like an archipelago of like islands, how did it become a tourist heaven?
Yeah, so in 1972, Maldives, we decided to start tourism. A lot of UNDP studies shows that it's very difficult because the infrastructure was not there.
Oh.
But we believed it and then started as a, you know, a very kind of a village tourism. We were a fishing village anyways at that time. So it started and with the, I would say, different successive governments, different tourism ministers, everyone contributed a lot. And we did through our master plans. And when I became Minister of Tourism in 2012, I got the opportunity to formulate the fourth master plan. And we focused on resort tourism because we are one of the nations where we have many small islands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we have many lagoons as well.
Oh, nice.
So by that point of time, we decided that we will go for expansion. So when we studied about expansion, we were inspired by UAE, actually, because UAE, we saw that they were in Dubai, we see the dredging of the palm, and also in Abu Dhabi, we see the islands. So why not Maldives as well? So I decided to change the regulations, but we did it sustainable way. So we started giving out lagoons. So now it has become another $1 billion industry where there was always a saying that Maldives will sink, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we started creating our own islands, which brought in a lot of investors,
mm-hmm.
new brands. So we have very nice, very good brands. Together with Maldives, we have been pushing for the to be the best of the luxury resort
mm-hmm.
destination, and we have achieved it.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of luxury destinations, I think the majority of people would have the Maldives as the number one spot. And there are a lot of island destinations trying to replicate the Maldives' success. So how, I mean, what do you believe sets the Maldives apart, and what unique approaches did you implement when you were the tourism minister?
So I believe that the government should work with the industry and together, because they are the investors. They know, and we have to be the facilitators.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I see even in UAE. The success comes together with the government and the partnership.
Of course.
So I believe Maldives, what we did was we focused on the resorts. That's the A part of it. Of course, there are guest houses, there are other places, but we marketed the best.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go back to 2012, we were perceived a bit lower than even Mauritius at that time.
Uh-huh.
Even the prices they achieved were better, performance was better. But we opened up, our air spaces, aviation, as well as now even private jets can come in even to the domestic airports, because we couldn't cater the private jets because it was so exponential,
mm-hmm.
and the New Year's, you know, all that. So,
yeah.
So I believe in opening up as a tourism destination. So for our Maldives, we decided to give visa for everyone in the world to welcome.
Mm-hmm.
So aviation.
Sorry to say this, but you're telling us about the whole journey, and you're called the man behind the Maldives. So is it part of, is it all these strategies of resorts and everything, is it part of the reason that you're called this?
I think people call me that because I think I was part of that journey, got to play a pivotal role, and I was very young as well. So we did a lot of, not only the milestones we achieved, but we celebrated a lot. I started celebrating each new year with a tourism big festival show. Free for all the local Maldivians to come in. We brought in Akon, Priyanka, and a lot of celebrities too. Because I believe it's the success of Maldivian people, right? So we have to celebrate with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, sorry, you talked about a lot of resorts. How do you go to private companies, private resorts, and pitch them Maldives? Because you say it started in 2010. How did you go to them, and what was the pitch like? Like, oh, come invest, or did you have something like, oh, this, we're going to achieve this, so we will need you there?
Yeah, Exactly. It's very complicated because we are not only telling them to build a hotel,
yeah.
we are telling them to build an entire island on their own because they will be doing their own powerhouse, their own water generation. Also, nice. The employees in the resort, they have to make accommodation for them as well. So it's like running on kind of your country, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's one island, one resort. And it gives a good ROI. If you see, Maldives is doing the highest, I would say, in the world.
Yeah.
Even our Hilton does around $800 and above per night. So that is the ROI is high, but the investment is also big.
Oh.
But I would say the exclusivity, and also I marketed in a way that we said that if you don't have your flagship in Maldives, you are not, you know, luxury resort brand, you know, so kind of that. So I think it went well, and I think we are doing very well on that part.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the controversial relationship between the Maldives and India. So recently, the Maldives relationship with India has seen sort of a downward journey rather than an upward one. So how do you think these political dynamics affect the tourism industry? And what could be the broader impact on how the Maldives is perceived internationally?
Yes, so the new government came in with a new president who inherited this campaign of India Out. So I was advocate on that on Indian media as well as all the current president as well as the ministers are my former colleagues. So I was able to kind of mediate in a way that that has turned down, and I think the relationship between Maldives and India has improved. Our president has visited Prime Minister Modi's inauguration, and also Foreign Minister Jay Shankar has visited us, as well as India has been very graceful in helping us, giving more time to repay some foreign debts and everything like that. So I think it's going to improve, and it's very important to have a very good relationship with India as well as all the other countries, because we are a touristic nation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have to welcome all, and we are too small, I would say, to get into geopolitical fights.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So yeah. How do you think is India as a tourist market from where people come to Maldives? Because again, numbers-wise, China, Russia and UK are the biggest countries or the exporters of tourism to Maldives. The number says it's like 165,000, more than 165,000 people came from China this year in the first 6-7 months. So China is a big industry, Russia and UK. Do you think India will grow back to become like one of the biggest tourism exporters for your country after mediations? And
I really believe that, because even if you see the COVID times, yeah. The whole world shut down, but I would say it was UAE and Maldives which opened up doors for the visitors. Mm-hmm. And India was so graceful to give us air corridor, we call it air bubble. So you would have seen all the celebrities, everyone came to Maldives. So India would have been 1-2 in the market segment last 4 years. And we didn't have any off-season because they were visiting even in the summer. So because of this, as you rightly said, it went down. But I would say with the new improvements, with the relationship, even our tourism minister visited India recently for a tour to get all the tour operators. So I would say with the improvement, I would say it will improve because we are too near.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you said that you learned from the UAE, correct? But what do you think the UAE can learn from the Maldives? Just what can they learn from each other?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we have so much synergy between us. I would say we are learning because I would say everything UAE is world class, I would say, the top management, everything. So we are learning a lot from UAE. So what we can contribute to UAE's development is that we have a lot of experience on the island development. Especially the exclusivity, especially the island hospitality and the private butlers that we have is renowned in the world. So I think there are a lot of things that we can also share between us. But I think we have a lot to learn from UAE, I would say.
So just to say, you talked about private butlers, a very interesting point. I was reading again that 7.7 to 8.1 days is the median range of people staying in the Maldives. So if I go, the average range is that I will stay there for 7 to 8 days. What do we do there? Like, what are the highest, like, industries, the biggest industries or the biggest things, the most important things that anyone does in Maldives? For people who haven't been to Maldives, what are the best things, like top five things to do in Maldives?
Yeah, thank you. So it's up to you, like the tourist. So, for example, a lot of people go there to rejuvenate, to cut out from the world, you know, just be there, just to feel the sea breeze. So Maldives is 32 degrees maximum and doesn't go below 27. So it's all through the year like that. And that rejuvenation you get just by sitting on the beach, on the shade, looking at the turquoise color water, that's enough to, you know, because when you're in these kind of cities, you burn out, right? So one thing is to rejuvenate, just it. To mediate, to do, you know, your yoga and all
that. It's more like a therapeutic journey to go to the Maldives.
That is one. But there is a lot of water sports that is under the water. It's one of the places where we can guarantee for you to see a tiger shark. There are spots, you know, and it's very safe because we have protected fisheries. We do sustainable fisheries. So the sharks, everyone has enough to eat, so they don't bite any divers. And also, water sports enthusiasts, divers, you know, safari boats, you know, luxury yachts. So it's there. It depends on the tourist.
What do you want to do?
What do you want to do?
I'm curious. So obviously the waters in the Maldives are pristine. I'm just going to talk from a sustainable point of view. How do you keep the water safe from any pollution from all the different tourists? Because you never know if somebody might come and pollute the waters or leave out trash. Or so how are there any initiatives to keep the Maldives waters looking as clear as they are?
Because tourists are famous for polluting every place they go to.
Again, it's mostly the beaches are resorts. They take care of their own beach. So hotel will be taking care of one.
Oh, I see.
So I always say that whenever we build a hotel, even if it's a lagoon, we build it, it becomes more sustainable because it's in their interest to keep it, the beaches, the house reef, everything sells, it's their sales, right? So they keep the beach clean, and we have sustainable, for the trash and everything to be collected and done. We have even a green fund. I implemented that, a green tax. In name of bed tax, it's a kind of green tax paid by the tourists to keep more sustainable for the resorts, and also government also helps on the on keeping it more sustainable for the resorts. So government collects the trash from each island and take it to one island.
Since you're the former tourism minister, I would love to ask you this question. What are the secret spots in Maldives that a lot of people don't go to and we should go?
Away from all the tourists.
Away from all the tourists.
Like a secret spot that is like the best thing to do in Maldives, secretly go there and do that.
Yeah, because when you go to a new country, you always try to spot like the hidden gems where like only the tourists go to, like where you see no other tourists, because I feel like you feel more like a traveler, like they're living in the footsteps of the local people. So,
or your personal favorite, even like, what is your personal favorite where you go when you are in Maldives?
So I think that there are a lot of sandbanks, you know, so you and your friends can go there, and when the boat leaves you there, you'll be kind of alone, you know. So it's just about you and your friends. You can spend a day there. And from the sandbanks, it's like the sand dunes here. You can walk. There are big lagoons where you can walk on the sand. So there will be somewhere you have to swim, somewhere you have to walk.
That's lovely.
It's like trekking.
That's amazing.
So there are very beautiful untouched places. We have untouched islands.
Nice. Wow.
Okay, so anything that you would want to add as the former tourism minister, vice president, why are you here? Are you planning anything with Dubai or in Dubai?
Yeah, so I would like to wish everyone happy World Tourism Day.
Yes, we let them know, yeah.
Yeah, and then also, I'm here to do a lot of strategic advising, advisory work for a lot of investors who would like to come to Maldives, mm-hmm. as well as there are a lot of other friends, investors who would like to invest in Dubai as well, mm-hmm. and promote it. And also I'm here to learn a lot about more, like the DIFC, the financial center, mm-hmm. the aspects of it. I think that can be the next thing for Maldives, because we have done very well the tourism, but we have to be diversified mm-hmm. as well.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ahmed Adib, for coming here and joining us today, and for telling us the secret spots in Maldives, and for all the other important information that you gave out.
Yeah, so thank you so much for joining us on the show. If you want to look back on the beginning of the show, or if you want to rewatch the interview, you can always find us on all these streaming platforms like Spotify and Rami and Apple Podcasts. As well as that, you can find us on social media platforms like X, TikTok, Instagram, Meta, YouTube. So thank you so much for joining us on the Smashy Business Show, a Smashy Business production, part of the Augustus Media Podcast Network. Thank you once again to Ahmed Adib for joining us on the show. We'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you for having me.
Of course.